Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector or an independent financial advisor looking for insights, analysis and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uesta. I do apologize for my husky voice today, but Mother Nature's cold Cape winter has not been kind to me. There are at least a few decibels left to have a constructive conversation with my guest today, Gareth Stobie. With over 20 years of financial services experience, he's one of the most seasoned executives I've ever dealt with. And I've known him and I've been around for many, many years. There are only a few people in this country that knows as much as he does about exchange traded funds, or ETFs for short. Gareth founded CoreShares in 2015, and I'm sure he finds it quite pleasing to see the operation blossom into a flourishing passive investment management business, an ETF issuer, which at the point of acquisition by 10X Investments not too long ago had approximately 13.8 billion rand under management. Gareth is now a Director of Strategy and Corporate Development at ETFSA and is working with other industry stalwarts such as Mike Brown and Narina Fisser. ETFs have been around since the early 1990s, but in recent years, their popularity has soared. Today, there are more ETFs listed on the JSE, 222 to be exact, than single shares. And today, we'll explore what's driving the surge, the latest trend shaping the ETF landscape, and what investors should keep an eye on moving forward. So with that all being said, welcome, Gareth.
Thanks, Ron, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
First up, let's talk about the massive growth in exchange-traded funds, which forms part of the exchange-traded product complex. According to recent data, global ETF assets surpassed a staggering $10 trillion in 2023. What are some of the factors that have fueled this growth, Gareth? And what do the numbers closer to home look like?
So, Ron, I think there are lots of things. Firstly, you know, ETFs are really the poster child of, the broader passive investment market, or the idea of investing very simply in an index or an index fund and simply buying the market. And that idea of simply buying the market is perhaps, more efficient than trying to stock pick. It's an idea that's been around since the 1960s, but for a long time was rebutted by the industry and kept out by the industry as something that, wasn't very pro capital markets, and people like Jack Bogle was called un-American and so forth. But over the last few decades, and particularly over the last two decades, the concept has really been accepted by the industry and by practitioners. So there's proof of concept around the idea of passive investing and the idea of investing in an index. And then, as I say, the ETFs is really one way to invest in an index. The listing of a particular fund and the units of that fund are then tradable on the exchange. And that in itself was another set of innovation, and it's made buying funds very seamless on major global markets. It's meant that technology platforms and trading platforms and different market participants can very seamlessly buy these instruments on the market. So it's coming together of a brilliant investment thesis, a proven investment thesis, together with the simplicity of trading on markets. And that's what's fueled the global growth in the ETFs. And obviously all of the other things that come with it, the diversity of the diversification of the instruments, the low-cost nature of them, the visibility of them on global markets. And in the early days, sort of post global financial crisis, when ETFs really started to take off, a lot of it was, a lot of the speculation at the time was that, this is just this is all because of, the cheap money that was available given the low interest rates, and, all markets were moving up, and therefore ETFs and passive investing was benefiting from this low interest rate, free money environment. But actually, that sort of message does a disservice to the real change that's happened at a practitioner level, at an investor level, where if you sit with your financial planner today, it's not around, well, which portfolio manager is going to shoot the lights out, or how do I make the most amount of money? it's become much more professional around outcomes-based investing and trying to work towards a particular goal. And once you start working towards a particular goal, buying whole asset classes like US equities, for instance, or global equities, you know, fits neatly into that sort of structural, systematic approach to achieving outcomes. So there's been a shift in how practitioners have approached the investment problem, and stock picking and trying to outperform the market has been deprioritized in favor of just keeping things simple, making sure that you're getting the asset class return, and so forth. And then perhaps lastly, you know, the link up with technology. So ETFs themselves are a technology. The funds are listed on the exchange, but there's this neat alignment between buying a listed instrument and all the different tech that's now available. You know, the rise of robo advisors, for instance, the rise of low cost stockbroking platforms has meant that it's very easy to get access to these sorts of instruments.
Gareth, what do the numbers at home look like? How much assets under management are we talking about?
So in the local market, you know, we've had a lot of new ETFs that have listed over the last couple of years. As you mentioned in your introduction, we now have over 200 ETFs listed. And we're closing in on roughly $200 billion under management. So that's not too, I think we're on about $180 billion odd. So that's pretty good going, but it's very small still in the context of a very mature collective investment scheme market that's well over $3 trillion. Under management. And so we have this disconnect between money under management in the pure ETF market versus, as I say, the traditional unit trust market. And ETFs are growing quicker, so their market share is rising, relatively speaking. But as you can tell just from the sheer, you know, relative size of those two types of funds, you know, there's a long way to go. And I guess that boils down to a couple of things. Firstly, I mean, CIS funds have been around just for, or unit trusts as we kind of call them more informally, have been around for a very long time. So there's obviously a lot of sunk investments and a lot of legacy assets that sit in that environment. And what's also happened over the last, you know, number of years is that the ecosystem that supports unit trusts, so the list, the different list platforms, the reporting platforms, all the different role players have really you know, built their practices and the industry sort of been built around the CIS market and the unit trust market rather than the ETF market. The ETF market operates in a different ecosystem, one that's also very robust and very large, being the exchange itself, but one that's not really linked up, for instance, to financial advisors and different users of these types of funds. So it's growing nicely, but way off its cousin, the collective investment scheme.
One of the most significant trends we're seeing is the rise of thematic ETFs. These funds focus on specific themes or sectors such as technology, clean energy, or artificial intelligence. Why are they becoming more popular? And do you believe they will continue to experience substantial growth in the medium to long term?
I think when one looks at thematic ETFs, it's and their popularity. I guess, you know, let's pick a theme, you know, biotech or something like that. You know, you'll have a particular theme or a particular part of the global economy that has been ring-fenced, and investors say, okay, well, I like the idea of that particular sector or subsector doing well over the next 5 to 10 years, given certain macro variables and certain tailwinds that are being experienced. And so instead of trying to, you know, research which stock to buy in that particular bio sector part of the market, you can just simply buy an ETF that has been prepackaged to exploit that part of the market. And that's been prepackaged either by, you know, an active asset manager or another index that's looking at different data that makes up that sector. So you're taking away the individual single stock risk of trying to buy a share within that sector that represents that growth story. You can buy a whole portfolio of stocks and away you go. The downside of these products is that you know, very often these themes are transient. You know, there's a particular reason why a sector or subsector or a theme is doing well at any given point in time. But that thesis generally has, you know, a time frame around it. You know, we believe this theme will do well over the next 3 years, and here's why. Which means that from a product point of view, it's not something you can buy and hold and put in the bottom drawer and just forget about forever, because you kind of want to be in the theme as the theme is running or doing well, and then disinvest from that theme when the theme is kind of played out. So that's one of the real downsides of thematic investing, is it can be quite faddish and short-lived in terms of the types of products that have become available. But as I say, it's a very easy, efficient way to simply buy the theme if you want access to that theme. From a technical standpoint, in terms of constructing portfolios, one of the better benefits of thematic funds alongside, say, normal market cap weighted funds or of various kinds, is that when you invest in these themes, the thematic funds will obviously look very different to the main index. So they've got very high, what we would call active share relative to the normal market indices. And that means that they've got great diversification benefits. So if you were to hold, you know, an S&P 500 ETF, for instance, or a top 40 ETF, and then alongside that, buy various themes that you think are going to do well over the next while, you know, infrastructure or water or you know, various metals or something like that, you know, then you can hold that as a satellite position, and you can immediately diversify your portfolio because you know that the shares in there aren't mega cap shares in the main index. And these products are a lot more expensive than normal market cap weighted products. So in an ETF world where, you know, the big global issuers like iShares and Vanguard and others have made investing in big global markets almost for nothing, you know, to total expense ratios well under 10 basis points. Thematic ETFs have also been a way for issuers to carve some market share in the market. So you've had firms like ARK in the US and Global X and others launch very niche products where they feel they can gather market share and they can actually make some margins. So instead of charging, you know, 10 basis points for the product, they'll charge 50, 60, 70, 80 basis points for the product because they really feel they're adding value within that particular theme and finding the group of stocks or the index that best represent that theme. So from an issuer's perspective, from the product provider's perspective, it's an opportunity to make some margin in the ETF market, which is otherwise very difficult. But it's also worth bearing in mind that the total thematic market is only just over 1% of the total ETF universe. So it gets a lot of noise, gets a lot of attention because it's very exciting. You know, you talk about these different themes, robotics and biotech and all these different themes. And you can kind of hone in on some of the stocks that are really doing well within those themes. But the reality is that within the broader ETF market, you know, they represent a small part of the industry.
Gareth, another trend that's gaining momentum is the growth of ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and governance, which investors becoming more socially conscious. Do you think that ESG ETFs not only offer a way to align with investors' respective values, but also hold the potential to reap financial benefits as well?
Yeah, in terms of the return side of things, I've never liked the idea of saying that, you know, if you invest in the ESG basket, you're going to get better returns because these companies are more sustainable. Because just intuitively, if you think about it, if you're investing in shares that are managing ESG well, they therefore lower risk shares and you should intuitively expect lower return, you know, in the classic risk return payoff profile. So in a rather cruel, ironic way, buying non-ESG shares may actually give you better returns because those shares are, you know, higher risk in many respects. So I don't like to look at it through the return lens, but in terms of making a difference to the world and how capital markets can really move the dial, is that listed companies globally have really had to work very hard to demonstrate what they're doing across you know, the environment, you know, in terms of their carbon footprints and so forth, socially, you know, their labor policies, and their social investments and so forth. And then obviously governance and making sure that all their boards and committees and so forth are structured correctly. They've worked very hard at this. It's been going for some time now. And they put out an enormous amount of data. I mean, if you look at any annual report of a major listed company, the ESG section gets a lot of attention. Now, this data is, as I say, it's there's a lot of it. It's heavy data. And it's become a big industry in itself to process this data, to sift through it, to make sense of it, to work out which companies are doing well in this field and which aren't. And some of the firms that are the best placed to manage all of this data, to invest in all of the infrastructure to process the data, are actually the index houses. So S&P Dow Jones and FTSE and MSCI and all of these major players, Morningstar included, have got the balance sheet and the investment firepower to invest in teams, invest in infrastructure and processes to sift through the data and put together different ESG indices, different ESG scores around how all these companies are doing. And once they've processed all of this data, they can put, as I say, indexes together, and the different asset managers can kind of, you know, use that data in different ways. From a pure passive or ETF perspective, you can have an ESG fund that is very similar to the market and might just exclude, for instance, you know, sin stocks like tobacco and alcohol and weaponry companies, for instance, but is otherwise very similar to the index. Or you can have an index that is very, very different to the normal market cap, where you majorly upweighting the very best stock per index that has scored well within the ESG environment. So the different ESG products are actually all can be extremely different from one another, how they've processed this data, how they've, you know, filtered it, and then how away from the flock investors want to be. You know, they can be ESG cognizant, be very close to the index, or they can be, you know what, we want all and we just want to reward, you know, the very best companies in each particular sector. And so this processing that's going, the way the capital flows are rewarding companies with good ESG scores is a great way to, you know, shape capital markets going forward, a great way to reward good behavior from these companies, which in turn obviously makes a big ultimate difference in the world. And it's been something that's been building and building and building basically my whole career, and it's becoming, you know, very mainstream now. So, you know, ESG almost isn't seen as an asset class. It perhaps shouldn't be seen as an asset class. It's just one extra filter to assess stocks in the same way as you would assess their liquidity or assess their profitability. Assessing their ESG score is kind of just another part of that process. It's really becoming ingrained in how we look at stocks.
Gareth, let's not forget about the rise of actively managed ETFs. Quite a few have been listed in South Africa over the last year, but historically ETFs have been synonymous with passive investing. However, actively managed ETFs, where portfolio managers now make the investment decisions, are becoming increasingly popular. But Gareth, will these active alternatives become the norm while still providing the flexibility and transparency of the traditional passive ETF?
Yeah, so it, in South Africa, we've seen a number of active ETFs come to market. So we're up to 8 now in the local market, and I'm aware of, you know, several more that are coming to market. And I guess there are a couple of different ways of looking at it. I think for the active managers who, for instance, might not be running ETFs, they might only be running, you know, trusts, it's an opportunity for them to access a new form of distribution. So instead of just having their off-market fund, they can now have a fund that's immediately available on market and all the benefits that come with that. For ETF investors who previously have been limited to just buying market cap weighted products, it is great to get different types of exposure that weren't previously easily available, you know, in index form. And the fixed income market jumps out in that category, because fixed income is inherently difficult to index. You know, usually only the big bond, government bond indices are indexed. But, you know, when it comes to corporate credit or bank, you know, bank notes and all the different parts of the fixed income market, active managers can add an enormous amount of value there. So that's a good example of where, from an investment thesis perspective, the active management component has added a lot of value and has, you know, meant that there's more accessibility to those types of strategies. So I guess the pros and cons from the investor's perspective, and the pros and cons from the issuer or the asset manager's perspective. And from my standpoint, you know, having given that ETFs have become so popular and so easily available on big global exchanges, it makes sense that active managers, even though they're running an active strategy and not a passive strategy, would make the units of their funds also available for trade on the JSE, and I mean on the JSE or any global market for that matter. I think it's a positive development. It maybe graze the idea or the link between ETFs and the passive industry, that link has sort of been severed now almost, because you can buy all sorts of different ETFs. But from an assets under management perspective, most ETFs are still passively managed.
One particularly noteworthy trend for me is the emergence of crypto ETFs. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in January approved the first U.S. spot Bitcoin exchange-traded funds. But experts have urged caution before piling into this long-awaited ETF. Do you think crypto ETFs will stick, or is it just a fad?
Well, I think if cryptocurrencies certainly don't seem to be going anywhere, they've been around for a long time now. Funny enough, just last night I was watching one of the Pick and Pay executives explaining how shoppers at Pick and Pay are using more and more Bitcoins to buy their groceries, which was news to me. So it obviously is gathering traction and has, you know there's hundreds of billions now invested in these cryptocurrencies. So the concept of the cryptocurrency seems well enshrined, and therefore to have an ETF that represents the price of the cryptocurrency makes sense as well, because it's a financial instrument like any other. So from, you know, the end of last year, beginning of this year, we saw a number of cryptocurrency ETFs list, particularly in the US market, which they hadn't been prior to that. And the iShares spot Bitcoin ETF, which has emerged as the flagship product, has already got over $20 billion invested in it, which is, you know, enormous amount of money. And that's just one of five. So, yeah, judging by the immediate popularity and the immediate take-up of these products suggests that they're going to be around for some time to come, and that there's going to be a lot more product proliferation around this particular theme. And yeah, we'll have to see where, you know, in 10 years' time, where we are in the whole crypto world and where crypto assets sit relative to fiat currency and that. But yeah, certainly the ETF version of it has gotten off to a massive start, if we look back at the last 6 months or so in particular.
As a last question, Gareth, we've always needed to keep an eye on regulatory developments. As the ETF market grows, so too does regulatory scrutiny. What changes in regulations could impact how ETFs operate, and what are the costs associated with them?
I think the big regulatory, the interesting thing from a regulatory standpoint in our local market over the last few years has been the disconnect between how ETFs are viewed from an exchange control perspective versus traditional unit trusts. So ETFs, if a management company launches an ETF on the stock exchange, there's no limit to And it's foreignly referenced, I should add that, but there's no limit to the amount that the asset manager can raise in that particular ETF. They can externalize as much as they want into the S&P 500, for instance. Whereas if they were running the same product as a traditional unit trust off the market, they would be constrained in terms of their prudential limits and their exchange control allowance. Now, that means that ETFs have got a huge regulatory arbitrage, shall we say. It's been granted because of the listing part, and it means that the Reserve Bank can monitor the flows and so forth. So I think a lot of asset managers that are feeling constrained in terms of the exchange control allowance may move into the ETF market so that they can get that foreign allowance. That's not a new regulatory change necessarily, but it's one that I feel will be taken advantage of more and more now, especially if these asset managers can manage those mandates actively. And then I think this shift towards active management ETFs has been a major one and is still really playing out over the last 12 months. So I said we're up to about 8 actively managed ETFs now. You know, there are hundreds of actively managed unit trusts. So I think this trend of actively managed products is going to continue for some time. I think the other part of your question was around costs. I think costs and fees have really, in many respects, stabilized in the industry. There was a time where, ETFs and index funds were shaking up the market and from a pricing point of view. But we've sort of settled at what is really fair value for money across the industry. You know, you get what you pay for type of thing. I would say that those are the two big things at this stage.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. And thank you, Gareth, for agreeing to join me on the show and for providing my listeners an ETF education. The options are almost overwhelming, so there is a lot investors need to consider when looking at this widening pool of growing options and in this evolving landscape. To all our CityWire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money, Markets and Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uester. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Until next time, goodbye.